Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Well, tonight's going to be a busy one. In a few moments' time, we'll have the first of two discussions taking place over the next couple of weeks that reflect on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. It's coming up in just a week or so's time. And love it or loathe it, the debate over origins fundamentally changed the way in which we think about religion and society. It's particularly significant for people of the book, Christians, Muslims and Jews. And in just a few moments, we'll be meeting some scientists who take both their religion and Charles Darwin seriously. They were participants in a conference held in Geelong a few weeks ago on science, religion and evolution. Since the world began, when a vicious creature took the jump from monkey to man. Elvis Costello, Monkey to Man. Now, there's a view on the truth of the subject, the truth or otherwise. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio, Digital Radio, Radio Australia, and via the web to the world. Charles Darwin caused a revolution in scientific thought. He was also used to kickstart a war between science and religion. But have Christians been suckered into a false fight they are bound to lose? 150 years after Darwin published On the Origin of Species, we're taking a fresh look at an old fight and perhaps a look to a new consensus. It's a pleasure to welcome into our studios this evening Associate Professor David Young of the Department of Zoology at the University of Melbourne and author of The Discovery of Evolution, Professor John Pilbrow, immediate past president of the Institute for the Study of Christianity in an Age of Science and Technology, and Dr. Nicola Hoggard-Cregan, lecturer in systematic theology at Laidlaw College at Auckland in New Zealand. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much for joining us. John Pilbrow, you've retired today as the president of a group that has had a very big year. 150 years on from the publication of The Origin of Species, why is it that this book has become the crucible of what seems a fight between science and religion, one that has been escalated in the last couple of years by the rather ferocious onslaughts of what the group that are called roughly the New Atheists, led by Richard Dawkins, among others? Why has the fight heated up?
Well, I think the fight has heated up in some quarters. I've been a Christian, committed Christian for over 50 years, and I've been involved in research for a good deal of that time. And I resolved almost 50 years ago that there was no conflict in my own mind about this, and I saw the pursuit of a career in science as certainly a Christian vocation, which has been very fruitful for me and very rewarding. You ask why is Darwin's influence so strong? Well, he defined a paradigm, which of course has been refined recently by recent discoveries in genetics and to do with DNA and so on and inheritance. It's a paradigm that stood the test of time, and it's still holding the top place. David Young would be better able to comment on that than I, being a biologist. But this year I did actually read The Origin for the first time and discovered a most remarkable document, the kind of which I've not found in my own discipline of physics, I have to say. Now, as to Richard Dawkins, he's, first of all, a very gifted and brilliant scientist, and I think that's universally acknowledged. I would judge that he's a bad metaphysician, because it seems to me, in The God Delusion in particular, but I've read most of his other works as well, he seems to take a view that science is all there is. But he seems to fail to realise that the assumptions on which science is based don't come from within science itself. They're really metaphysical assumptions about things like the reliability and regularity of the world, the reliability of the kind of data we're able to collect or find in experiments, for example, and that the pursuit of this, involving our intellect and our thoughts and analysis, is a valid way to learn about the world, and that in fact we're not misled by what we learn.
Nicola Hoggard-Cregan, let me come to you now as a theologian. And look at the religious perspective on this. I mean, does religion have a problem with science, and why?
Well, I don't think it does, although what it is the problem. And I take issue with the language of war and fight that
we journalists are prone to. Yes,
that's right. Because in some ways it just exacerbates the problem. And, of course, there has been a wide range of reactions to Darwin and to science in general. And many of the earlier scientists were, of course, Christians and believers, and they found it an affirmation of their faith rather than undermining it. And even, I know, after Darwin, of course, there were many who found, you know, he found an enthusiastic response in many, or at least a sort of very mixed response, and so there hasn't really been a war right from the beginning.
Well, let me ask you another question that throws perhaps a little light, or maybe even some fog on it. Does Orthodox Christianity require, as some would have it, a denial of the principles of evolution?
No, I don't think it does at all. But I do think that some doctrine needs to be rethought in light of evolution, but that certainly it's not at all inconsistent with it, no.
You have, I'll bring, if I could bring David Young into the discussion now. David Young, you have a moment in time that seems at the present where this issue is becoming more important than ever, simply because of the implications that not adopting a coherent understanding between science and religion could place in peril the very future of the planet. Not to put too fine a point on it, Christian fundamentalists in the United States, who actually are very sceptical about climate science, are a very powerful influence on the US Congress. So these matters are not just erudite and arcane, they have a very practical reality attached to them.
Yes, okay, that sounds fine, and I think probably the main point I would wish to come at that is that I feel strongly that extreme views are not helpful on this issue to either science or religion, and that actually I think modern science is probably as much at risk as religion in this heated debate, and it really doesn't help science to represent it with the kind of strong language that you've referred to from certain modern leaders. And it's an interesting question as to what's actually the emotional drive behind this rise in much more offensive language that's being used at the present time. So I think that it would be much better to keep as calm as we can and to discuss these issues sensibly. And I certainly don't see a problem between basic evolutionary concepts and the Christian concepts of creation. And they were really resolved in the church decades ago. And so this is a new thing, as you say, a modern movement that's cropped up and is causing upsets out in the general audience there.
Nicola, let's just explore, just for a brief couple of minutes, the question that is at the heart of this. How do we read, or how should people read, the first couple of chapters of the book of Genesis? Because here it seems that those most concerned with this issue, on the religious side at least, are pouring all their energy. You get the Institute for Creation Science, you get all of these bodies, some of them with Australians attached to them, pushing very hard that unless we believe in the literal meanings of the words of the first two chapters of Genesis, then the whole edifice of Christianity in particular collapses. We have no moral compass. So let's just spend a couple of minutes unpacking what you, as a systematic theologian and something of a biblical scholar, understand what we're holding when we're reading those first couple of chapters of the book of Genesis.
Yes, well, I don't think it's ever been a good reading of Genesis to read it literally. And, I mean, I think it's a very, very deep book, and it does sort of endlessly give us new insights into the nature of God and the nature of humanity.
And those who were writing it at the time knew they were writing metaphorically?
Well, I think that was the way they thought. It wasn't, I mean, we might have to sit down and think, well, no, I'm going to write metaphorically, but they didn't, because it came naturally, and it was just the way that they were thinking. Mm. And it's we who find it hard to think that way, rather than, they didn't have a problem with that. And I think that to unpack it and to see its poetry and to realize that they were writing either in reaction to the Egyptians or to the Babylonians is very important.
They were making a theological statement.
Yeah, they were making theological statements, but they were also making statements about the nature of the universe and the reason for evil and things like that. I'm not convinced that that is the only problem that Christians have with evolution. I think that the question of whether or not we can discern purpose is also one of the reasons that some Christians have trouble. But it does seem to all be centered on Genesis very often. Yes, you're right.
Yes, I'll come to some of those other reasons later, because I do think there is an important argument to be teased out there, and I'd like to come back to that. But John Pilbrow, there was a mention of the fact that this reading of Genesis as a literal document in which the statements in Genesis have the same equivalence in truth content as a scientific statement is a late reading, that in fact it's a perversion of the very scientific revolution that many of the Christian fundamentalists are so opposed to.
I think that's right. The problem, it seems to me, is that people want to read it like they read the Herald Sun or a tabloid newspaper, and I think that's to do a great disservice to the text. And I've been informed by reading it in a more meditative way and trying to understand its underlying meaning. That's been a process that's gone on for a very long time and will still go on. And I think the other thing you have to realize about this particular text is that it's a universal one. It's one that we can deal with meaningfully today, and one that I believe would have been meaningful to the people of the time it was written, and that they wouldn't have had any idea of the kind of scientific analysis or data that is available to us today. The real truth of it lies, I believe, as Nicola has said, somewhere else. It's a deep truth. It's about our relationship to God, his relationship to us, our relationship to each other, and our relationship to the world.
And this factual means of reading, and I'd invite Nicola or David to comment on this, this factual way of reading, this literal factual way, is something that comes in the 16th century with Newton and with the scientific revolution. It's a new way of approaching knowledge generally, and people then impose that almost a sort of ex post facto on the Bible when the Bible had never historically been seen in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, people can quibble about the dating, and I mean, the Reformation could also, in some ironic way, be at fault in the sense that so much emphasis was then placed upon the Word of God above all other means of accessing God.
Yeah, so once the Word is elevated, you then have to decide what is meant by the Word. And once a new reading of it comes along, you have to make a decision. Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting if you go back and you look at even at people like Augustine and Aquinas, they caution about reading the Bible too literally.
They do, that's right.
So where does this new thinking take hold? Why does it spread so quickly? Have any of you sort of looked into that? And was it, in fact, due to the agitation of a few people who were anti-religion? And I'm thinking here particularly of the man known as Darwin's bulldog, Huxley, and his desire to drive religion out of education.
Well, that was a bit more complicated. I think Huxley was particularly concerned that, in his view, the church was still seeking to control the knowledge and information flow. And I think many of us today who are Christians would, in fact, have agreed with his desire to have that issue brought out in the open. It's very important to realise that the rise of modern science in the 19th century was a watershed, not just in relation to Darwinism, but there were things happening in my discipline of physics that have been just as profound in a way, but have sort of been hidden under the radar of most people. Electricity coming from Faraday's work and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which in fact anticipated two things, both the very radio waves that we're using in this broadcast tonight, but also it anticipated Einstein's relativity, although it wasn't recognised until much later. And so these are just as profound in their way, and in their own way have as much impact, I think, on what happens in our modern world.
And again, it marginalises the Bible as the centre of all truth. It shifts. Science all of a sudden becomes the paradigm of all truth, the default position, if you like. Now, I'm using truth in a very particular way there, in a very popular way of using the word truth. But there, a shift goes on, a sort of tectonic shift, in the general disposition of society. I mean, you have the age of the progressives in politics as well, which would add emphasis to that humanity can find a way through these things through humanity's own skill and drive.
Yes. There's another aspect to this too, which is that man no longer seemed to occupy the central place that people had very often traditionally believed, and that the implied connection of man to chimpanzees and earlier primates and right down the evolutionary tree seemed offensive to some people and felt that it denied them what they thought was the image of God in them. I don't believe it really has that impact at all. But
yes, there's a sort of moral offence there in that we are associated with the beasts, and beasts is beastliness, and beastliness is immoral.
And we're somehow diminished by having that knowledge.
Yes.
And my view is that we have nothing to fear from proper scientific knowledge, and I believe Christian faith and Christian theology equally have nothing to fear from the knowledge we have through evolution and other branches of science.
I want to shift to another element of the politics of this and shift on to the 1920s as another example of where there was a major movement in this debate, and that's the famous Scopes monkey trial in the United States, where a high school teacher is prosecuted for teaching evolution in schools. It's sensationalised by journalist H.L. Mencken, and then later on made into a wonderful film starring Spencer Tracy and Frederick March called Inherit the Wind. And it seems that science once again triumphs over ignorance. A recent biography of William Jennings Bryan, the man who carried the losing banner for the religious side in that great trial, points out that what was offensive to William Jennings Bryan about all of this was the way in which Darwin's theory had been captured by a philosophy promulgated by Spencer on the really nature red in tooth and claw, on social Darwinism, that in fact this was the way society was meant to be. And so Christians, people with a wanting to apply a moral framework, again had a reason to take offence against a scientific reading of the world, or as seen through the eyes of Spencer and his followers. Does anyone take that up and comment on it?
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. And I mean, a lot of things were happening in the Scopes trial, of course, and there's two sides to every war. And And the Scopes trial, I think, was a set-up job as well. You know, the Liberals were looking for a fight.
Yes, the American civil liberties.
That's right, yeah. But, I mean, I do think that, that there is this deep discernment that that there is something about Darwinism that is perhaps not ethically right, and that if you start applying it to society, it goes wrong. And, of course, it did go wrong in the eugenics movement in America and in other parts of the world, and in Germany especially. And so I think these sort of deep uneasiness is not unreasonable and is probably a part of the overall distrust of Darwinism and of intellectuals.
David Young, it makes it a problem for those such as yourself who want to wed your understanding of the universe together with a theory of evolution or, and again, I'm using the word in a very sort of crude sense, but in an evolutionary view of the cosmos. And you've written about it. I mean, the discovery of evolution is something that you are sufficiently concerned about to say, look, there is something beautiful and good about this, despite the negative reading that can be given out of it, indeed the negative application if you use radical social Darwinism. There is still something beautiful and good in this that needs to be seen.
Well, yes, I think that's right. And the story I try and tell in that book is what the historians call an internalist history. I look at the scientific problems as they came up and then see how they were solved. And if you look at the 19th century, and as I've had a fresh look at Darwin, what's really clear is that in the early part of the century, the species problem, as it was called, became a hot topic of the day, is that it began to be recognised that a whole lot of species were going extinct over vast periods of time. So then the question was, well, how on earth do new species come into existence? And that was debated, and Darwin was not the only one to deal with it. And I think that when Darwin, in particular Wallace, came up with this excellent theory that was worked out in so much detail and effectively solved the species question, the trouble then is when you get a piece of science that's well established and can be used, then everybody in sight starts to use it to justify their own position. So in the 20th century, you not only had, well, sorry, in the 19th, you get extreme capitalists like Spencer. Then in the 20th, you get both the communists and the fascists who use it to justify their positions. And so I think, to be fair to science, that it's an excellent scientific theory that has been upheld and is central to modern biology, but it gets taken over by all sorts of people who want to then use it to justify some ideology or political position or whatever.
I guess you have summarised very neatly there the first 25 minutes or so of our discussion, because we've gone through almost cyclical stages where from Darwin's introduction of his book, you have it argued about by others wanting to use it as a weapon, starting with Huxley, then moving on into the 1920s with those who wanted to use it to advance a Spencerian agenda, then on now to the present day, where again you have it being used for polemical political reasons.
Definitely, yeah.
And at the moment, it seems as though religion has, Christianity, to a certain extent the United States, has been gulled into playing that game again. And it's a game it doesn't need to play, because if it does play it on those terms, religion itself risks being damaged, does it not? That is, if religion keeps demanding, or Christianity keeps demanding, to accept a literal reading of Genesis, then it will become increasingly marginalised, that the strength of Christianity historically has been the way it has been able to accept and blend both natural revelation and the revealed word.
Yes, quite so. And what's interesting about that is that it's a peculiarly American problem. As you mentioned, the Scopes trial was 1920s, and then this new version of creationism that even denies the age of the earth, that began, I think it was Henry Morris in about 1961 or so, that wrote a book not just denying evolution but tossing out that as well. So you're ending up in a position where if you adopt that, you're really tossing out the whole of modern science. And that makes things very hard. I've had one of my students, I remember her saying to me that she met up with a group of Christians and they were such lovely people, but they believed these weird things and that put her off connecting with them anymore. So it is a real problem. Equally, on the other hand, I don't know the answer to this, but we've got what seems to me an equally emotional response against religion from the Dawkins and Hitchkins and so on, that is now equally damaging to science, really, as a way as the other is. As I said before, I think those extreme views don't help either side, and so religion's not helped by an extreme view based on a literal interpretation of Genesis, and I don't think science is being helped by an extreme view with lots of strong language based on a very rigid interpretation of a Darwinian perspective.
Yes, the paradox there, it seems to me, is that both groups, both the fundamentalist literalist Christians and the Dawkins-Hitchens view of science basically rely on a very reductionist approach to language.
Yes, and sometimes I have been cornered occasionally both by creationists and by atheists, and it's actually a very similar experience in both cases. The psychology underlying it must be rather similar, that in a sense they're both a kind of fundamentalist seeking some certain truth, very definite, and it's actually a bit similar talking to both group individuals from both sides.
Just get them in a room together and knock them around a little.
As long as I'm not there.
Well, Dawkins did to have such people on his the BBC program that was relayed through the ABC a few years ago.
Yes.
He seemed to have a capacity to find people who were really right out at sort of the fringe of this sort of issue. And I think that didn't help Dawkins, and I don't think really helps any of us sitting around here, around these microphones tonight.
Yes, yes. John Pilbrough, you also mentioned that you're a physicist, and evolution as it's come to be understood in modern terms really is much broader than biology. As David mentioned, it picks up geology, but it also now goes into genetics. If you spread out into physics, it has implications for physics. In fact, those who are opposed to evolution begin to argue with cosmology, contemporary cosmology as it's understood. Mm. So you have a debate here that begins to take on not just a narrow theory in biology, but in fact the whole edifice of modern science.
Well, in retirement, I've interested myself in reading across the spectrum from biology to cosmology and astrophysics to try and inform myself a bit better about these things and to think about the metaphysical implications of a lot that's being said. Let me make a sort of a general statement, which I've used in talks to student Christian groups on campus over the years, that I see the cosmological, geological and biological stories as forming one part of a grand narrative. But I do need to make some distinctions. I see that in biology, the evolutionary paradigm is an overarching paradigm, which, as Dobzhansky said in the 30s, without which biology makes no sense. The geology comes in because, of course, the fossils have contributed enormously to the understanding. When we come to cosmology and astrophysics, the story is incomplete, but it's in many ways quite coherent from about what's called Planck time, not quite at time zero because we don't know the physics right back that far, but from the Planck time, which might look to most people as a zero, but it's very close to it, up to the present. The processes in general are fairly well understood. The physics of it is fairly well understood. What's missing is an explanation at this stage of what's called dark energy and dark matter, and these are matters really beyond my own expertise. But we don't throw out that theory because of it. Now, I want to comment on the implication from your earlier remarks that evolution is used right across the scientific spectrum. This is true. But at the same time that it's used to talk about the evolution of the universe, the processes that are implied in cosmology are in many ways different from what the evolutionary process really means in biology. And David Young might is better able to comment on that than I am. And I'll just make one final remark and stop and let him and Nicola have a turn. as David referred to speciation previously, that's a very important part of the evolutionary paradigm. And it's the way, and it's trying to find ways to understand how new species arise. And that story is now embedded in our genome in a very dramatic way. And you can take the biological time clock back quite a long way on that basis. So when we talk about the evolution of the universe, we're not talking about speciation in the sense in which it's used in biology. And while I'm happy for the term to be used in cosmology, I think we do need to understand that it's used to mean something a little bit different from what the use in biology is.
David Young, let me take you up on that, just with this one term, because it is a term that throws itself around in this discussion, particularly when you're dealing with those who want to take a creationist view, is this question of speciation. It's as if there is a magical dividing line which one can pick between species, and that species don't cross that boundary. Yet, from my reading, perhaps it's an ignorant one, of evolutionary science, the closer you get to that boundary, the fact that it melts away, that things just gradually change into other things through various processes until they can no longer copulate. And at that point, you begin to have the emergence of a species, perhaps not totally, but over time.
Yes, that's quite right. And so that process is called speciation. And I think it's rather nice that probably the best account of that, or certainly one of the best accounts that we have, is done by Peter and Rosemary Grant, who've worked on Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands, and they've actually mapped out the process. And a nice book of theirs that I'd recommend is called How and Why Species Arise, or something like that. And so they've looked at that in detail, and the processes that do lead to population splitting up, and then if they should happen to meet up again, becoming incompatible and so on. So that's really been worked out nicely in the 20th century, and recent genetic and molecular studies certainly helped to boost that understanding in the 21st century. And the basic idea that it must happen was first sorted out in the 19th century. So it's an unfolding part of biology that is now really well established, and it's a fascinating field.
Nicola, let me ask you something, and then I'll ask both David and John to comment on this. Does scientific knowledge, that's contemporary scientific knowledge, necessarily require that we abandon certain ideas about God, particularly that there is an interventionist God?
No. I mean, I think during the 20th century, that idea was given up largely in some areas in deism and in process theology. But no, I think we can maintain some sort of interventionist God, not an interventionist God in the way perhaps that we think of it.
Not the magician, but
a God who does answer prayer, and who, a God who's present in the creation in spirit and in logos, but not in the way in which we would necessarily expect. And, I mean, I think, what, I mean, one of the extraordinary stories in Scripture really is the story of the birth of Jesus, which was accompanied by, the massacre of the innocents. And this sort of combination of, the great incarnation happening at the same time as this terrible evil is something that Scripture speaks of quite freely. At the same time that we are told, that God is there in the spirit. And although it's not very easy to understand, I think we have to hold on to both of those things, that a God who is with us and present with us, as well as the sort of scientific understanding of cause and effect. And I don't think they cancel each other out.
No, this ultimately does come down, once one thinks it through, to essentially the ground of one's being, as Paul Tillich famously put it. John and David, what sort of... if this matter is so important for you, why is God important, and what sort of God is important for you? John?
Can I just make a comment on what Nicholas just said? I actually prefer to use the term that God interacts rather than intervenes with us in prayer and in the world generally. Because for me, the idea of intervention sort of has the the idea of God jumping in now and then to sort of tinker with things and to sort of try and fix things up. But the idea of God interacting with the world, to me, is a much richer metaphor, because God as the creator is not his creation, but he is, I believe, able to interact meaningfully and creatively within that creation, and to communicate with us. And, you know, this raises the issue of the emergence of consciousness and spirituality and so on. And you ask, why is the idea of God, in my case, I hold a fairly conventional view, I believe. But for me, looking back to when I became a Christian as an undergraduate, it was, in fact, a quite meaningful encounter with Christ. Someone was there, just momentarily, and it was a turning point. So I turned from unbelief to belief, and I've not wavered in that in over 50 years. And that's, to me, a very sort of remarkable thing. I don't see God as sort of the benevolent bearded character in the sky portrayed in, you know, some pictures of God. Rather, God has come to us in the person of Jesus Christ. Nicola referred to the Logos, which is a very meaningful metaphor for me too. And in fact, if you go to the prologue to John's Gospel, I think there's a very important link between the Word, the Creator is also the Word, but the Word came in the flesh, and that Word is recognized as Jesus Christ. And you see that the Christ who came, that Nicola talked about, the birth of Jesus, is intimately related to the very creation and order that we have around us today.
And he went around doing good.
Yes.
David?
Yes, can I actually redirect the discussion towards Darwin and evolution? Because there's a really interesting point there that before Darwin's time, the argument from design was very strong and favourable. And I'm sure people have heard of books like William Paley's Natural Theology.
Yes, this is the man who first got the watchmaker image that Dawkins used.
That's it, exactly. And what's interesting about that is it has a double effect. On the one hand, it encourages the study of animals and plants as God's creation. On the other hand, it suggests that they are the result of divine interference and not of natural laws. So in the early 19th century, you had this curious situation where physics and chemistry seemed to work through natural laws, but not in biology. And people were actually saying that at the time. So you had some people saying, using phrases like creative interference to describe the appearance of new forms of life on Earth. But other people were saying, now surely it's a more appropriate view to think of God working through natural causes to produce new species. And so that discussion was actually going on before Darwin,
prior to
the origin of species, yes.
It's a very interesting observation. We've only got about 10 minutes left in this conversation. You've been very patient. I'd like to move it on now to where we are at the moment, the whole issue of climate change. And as I alluded to earlier, those opposed to climate change, particularly in the United States, have drawn on many of the resources gained through their association of creationism and wedding it to what's been called the religious right in the United States. So once again, religion is being dragged in a matter that is critical for the scientific future of the planet. And ultimately, upon their view, is hitched to a religious understanding of the nature of God in the world. That is God good and are we stewards of creation, or is the world basically damned and the future will be wiped out according to whatever premillennial discourse you want to get involved in? This now becomes a critical issue. How important is it now for you as responsible scientists and other responsible theologians to get together and say to people, look, you've got to sort this out urgently because the fate of the planet depends upon it? John Pilbrow.
Well, I think that's right. It's not an area I've been directly involved in, but I'm aware of the physics of the situation, in particular the the doubling of the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere compared with 1946 levels. And if you go back to the ice cores of the Antarctic back about 800,000 years, I mean, nothing like this has been seen in that time span. The question of our stewardship of the Earth, that's a very important principle, which one gets out of Genesis 1, Genesis 1:26, I think it is. And that's reminds us that that it's not our world, it's God's world, and that we're called to be responsible for what we do within it. And the sad thing for me is to find Christian people who presumably, like me, are keen on the truth, nevertheless, as you say, joining those who want to deny that this is happening and to say that it's you know, just something which is a natural variation. I'd like to point out that one of the key players internationally in promoting the discussion of climate change is Sir John Horton from the UK, who won the Japan Prize 3 years ago. He's a Christian. I've known him for nearly 50 years now. And he did perhaps as much as any to get this issue onto the agenda. And he's a committed evangelical Christian, very much aware of the implications of doing nothing. He was a very important figure in the early days of the International Panel on Climate Change. And wrote about it and wrote about his Christian reflection on it, on the very issue of our responsibility as stewards of the planet.
David Young, as somebody who's specialised in evolution and evolutionary biology, we've mm-hmm. seen enough of species coming and going from this planet over time. Much of the evidence suggests that certainly in some of those great extinctions, there were there could have been climate-related issues, that the planet doesn't need us to necessarily renew itself.
Well, that's right, and in that context, the human species seems to bear an embarrassing resemblance to the comet that hit the Earth 65 million years ago and wiped out a whole lot of species, in that we seem to be having much the same effect at the minute. And the difficulty really is for most people is understanding the complexity of an ecosystem, that evolutionary biology works at different levels. We've heard about genes and molecules, but equally important are environments and populations and the big picture. And what happens is, once you start losing one species here and one species there, oh, and another one over there, then a whole ecosystem can collapse.
And the web begins to crumble.
Yes, that's it. So, you know, the minute you might say, oh, look, we've only lost a couple of spotted parrots, who cares about that? But then a little bit further down the track, oh, those frogs have gone as well, and oh, that's gone. And then suddenly one particular ecosystem is really on the verge of collapse. And basically our existence depends on a ecosystem that's working. So that if we don't look after it, it's certainly not going to look after us.
Yes, so the fact that the frogs around the world are dying and people were panicked about it, then they found, oh, look, this can be explained because frogs are becoming susceptible to a certain virus. That's no relief, because the fact that they're susceptible to a certain virus is an indication of the very ecological change we should be worried about.
Yes, that's it.
Oh, this is not a good picture for us. Nicola, your job here is to introduce hope into the equation. Is it not vitally important that those concerned with theology begin to apply themselves to scratch where people itch? And surely here, theology, and particularly the sort of Christian theology you've been articulating, has a vital role in helping people have a comprehensive worldview that will enable them to say, yes, I have a responsibility to save the planet, that's not only practical, it resonates with my faith.
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, and I do think that in spite of all the evidence, we have to believe in faith that humans are a part of the solution as well as the problem, and that, you know, that we're a part of the intended healing of the Earth as well as its, you know, as its undoing. And a part of that, of course, is also making peace, because a world at war can't deal with climate change either. And I think there are Christian voices speaking out. I mean, they might not be the loudest ones, but they certainly are speaking out. And they're attempting to address the issues of eschatology and to sort of say that, you know, that what scriptures really are speaking of is a new heavens and a new earth, which is, includes, in some transformed way, this present earth, and not the burning up and destruction of it, like the Left Behind series might suggest. And these voices are there, and there is evidence that they are having some effect, but you know, it's sometimes difficult to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
And it's a job that theology has to apply itself to, not just for the survival of the church, but given that a large portion of the planet is still religious and the Muslim, Jewish and Christian traditions all draw out of that book, that if that can be applied and taught and accepted, then you have a reason for not only just a good piece of news for the planet, but a renewal of that whole religious enterprise, in that it again reattaches religion to the real world.
Well, I think religion has to be, and faith has to be reattached to a real connection to nature as well. And that some of this emphasis upon propositions and has separated us and alienated us from nature. And I mean, that's a great strength of Darwin, is that Darwin has also shown us our interconnection at all levels of life, and so that's where I think, you know, that religion and science can also have a common purpose, which is in appreciating and in connecting again to the natural world.
John Pilbrow, we've got about a minute left. You're somebody who's just finished your term on this the enterprise. I could use that as Starship Enterprise here. We're all aboard this little small spaceship Earth. What for you are now the critical issues that we've got to face, and where religion and science should be mutually supportive?
Well, first of all, I think we've got to talk in terms of having a conversation and not at all a confrontation. Confrontations don't really solve anything. We need to sit down, theologians and religious people need to sit down with scientists and start to ask some questions about what it is we believe, what our concepts are, and understand, listen to what each other says before we start firing missiles at one another, which is not at all helpful. I think an important issue which does need to be addressed in the coming century is to be able to demonstrate, both from the religious, in our case Christian point of view, and from the scientific point of view, that science is in fact a valid way of looking at the world.
In fact, it's a way that's maybe provided by the Creator.
Well, I'd say it's God's gift to the world.
John Pilbrow, thank you very much. David Young and Nicole Hoggart-Cregan. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.